morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everybody. This is Tony, and you are listening to Tales from the Couch Zone. And as always, I'm joined by co-host Dazza. Dazza, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you. I've actually invented a new drinking game.
Oh, God, here it comes.
Yeah, basically, every time that UFC shows the Paige Van Zandt knockout of Beck Rawlings last night, you have to take a shot. Because I have a feeling we're going to see that knockout a lot.
I think you may die of alcohol poisoning if you do that.
Yeah. So some people in this world are just basically just sort of, you know, gifted with incredible luck, because she's got the look, everything. She's got the personality that she's going to be a star in that. She's sort of, you know, she's, I won't say she's like a world-class fighter at this point, but she's exciting enough and does stuff. And now she on TV, she manages to pull like this highlight reel knockout out of nowhere against a sort of an opponent who is cut, you know, quite popular and well-known and has a reputation for being tough as well. It's just like everything's just going for it at the moment. But yeah, that knockout, that was sort of just
I would say, Dazza, give it time, especially with that division the way it is, the Rose Nakayumez's and the... Yeah, Joanne Dronchichik, I can't imagine that she'll be on her winning ways for a very long time, I can imagine.
No, but I just get the impression she's going to be one of these. But there's plenty of fighters in that division that you can basically keep her away from, you know, the top notch, as it was. Because, I mean, like, Tisha Torres really wants to have a fight with her, which, you know, again, Tisha Torres is another one who's like, she's a popular fighter, but she's never going to do anything, you know, right at the top of a ladder. But you put her in against Paige, and that would be like a really exciting fight. You got something like Michelle Waterson, that could be an exciting fight. So
ooh, that's a perfect, that's dream booking right there, Dazza.
Yeah, yeah. I think she's got that thing that she can be sort of popular without having to basically be put in against Joanna Jędrzejczyk, if I pronounce that right, I probably didn't. But yeah, she's sort of, you know, she's got that thing that you can sort of like, you know, get a lot of mileage out of her. But yeah, I mean, she's one of these as well, she probably won't necessarily have to be in the sport for life. I'm sure, you know, she'll have the offers coming and stuff.
I put her on par with maybe the Sage Northcutts of the world, where really, yeah, they shouldn't be in the UFC. They really have no business in the UFC, but the fact that they look the way they look, that's probably why they're there right now. Paige Van Zandt, if she was maybe finding an Invicta and getting more experience and maybe getting a little bit older, like maybe, what is she now, like 21, 22?
I think she's 23.
Yeah, maybe when she hits like her late 20s, she may really, especially with her training at, I think, doesn't she train at Alpha Male?
I don't know exactly what she's training. She's training with somebody big, I know that.
I've seen her training with Faber, so I just naturally assume, because that's his camp, that's where she trains out of. So yeah, I have to imagine, you know, it's, and someone that I guess it's going to get the best attention, they're going to get the best trainers and everything. You just have to imagine that given a couple of years and maybe, you know, a couple of big wins, some experience in the cage, that eventually she's probably going to be a pretty good fighter in her own time.
Yeah. Well, you know, she's, like I say, she's got that, you know, her fights are normally exciting. I mean, she's got that sort of, you know, that really fast, energetic style and stuff. So she's sort of, you know, you can see where the popularity is and the looks and everything. And she's almost, I think, you know, she's got that almost like a mini Ronda Rousey type thing to her in the terms of looks and the sort of, you know, the glamour and everything like that. But, yeah, you know, she'll be fun for a while.
Dazza, I think we have some breaking news. I was just informed by my friend Dave Penton, formerly of ComicConversations.com. Apparently the pro wrestler and manager, Mr. Fuji, has died.
I noticed that just as we were going to go on. But I saw a thing, but I didn't get a chance to actually click on it just to see if it was genuine.
How many times have we seen that? Like, what was it, Jackie Chan is dead? Yeah, it's confirmed by WWE.com. WWE Hall of Famer Mr. Fuji passes away.
That's really sad. Fuji is one of those, because I mean, I probably sort of remember him a lot more than you, because I'm playing the old man card. Because he was like, you know, it was like a big it was a bit, sort of a big deal in the 80s. It was a bit of a strange one because his role was the, I mean, he was a wrestler before that and everything, but when I was watching, he was basically, his career was gone and he was a manager. And normally in that era of the WWF, the manager was always there to be the mouthpiece. So the wrestlers who couldn't necessarily have the personality and the sort of, you know, ability to, you know, do interviews and stuff like that. He, you know, the idea was that they, you'd have the Bobby Heenan and the Slick and everything to, you know, basically be the talker for them.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, Fuji wasn't a good talker. You know, he would just say like a really.
Well, for his gimmick, it didn't matter if he talked all that well, but you're right.
That's the thing, because he had this, you know, he's sort of, you know, his gimmick was basically to be the evil heel who would basically interfere in the match, you know, against the bad guys. But like I say, that's, you know, that's not what really what the managers were at that point. You know, he wasn't a good talker or anything, but he did used to be in the top programs because he was really big with the tag team wrestling because he managed Demolition. And then he managed the Powers of Pain.
By the way, Demolition, greatest wrestling theme ever of all time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I really love the Demolition Act anyway. I thought the aura that they had with the, even though there was, you know, meant to be a Road Warriors knockoff, I still absolutely love that gimmick, that whole package. Orient Express, it was, you know, he managed them. And then he actually ended up in the main event programs because he was the manager of, he got away from the Dr. Fu Manchu outfit, and he basically became Yokozuna's manager.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like a big deal because that program, well, basically was like world champion and everything. He was basically in with Hogan. It was in with sort of Lex Luger and everything. And he was, you know, when you look at it, he had sort of, you know, a long career, you know, with WWF, you know, I think he outlasted most of the managers there. He's one of those things that he's always seems to, I think there must be something really popular with him and with the sort of like, you know, with the boys, as they say, because they always used to talk about him like with fondness. In sort of interviews past, they've never sort of like, you know, really forgotten, you know, Mr. Fuji. You know, he would basically appear on sort of comedy skits and stuff like that. And but really, really sad news. How old was he? Have you got?
He's 82. Yes, I have it all in front of me. This doesn't have the cause of death, but he did in fact live to see 82.
Yeah. Did he ever go into the Hall of Fame?
I believe so. Let's see if I can't find that.
I would have thought so, because...
Yeah, he's someone that you would expect to be in the Hall of Fame. If he's not in the Hall of Fame now, you have to imagine that he's going to be in the Hall of Fame probably this year or next year with Mania coming up. Let's see if I can look that up really quick. I have to imagine. I'm here on WWE.com. I was trying to find if they gave the reason why he passed away. But I guess this is so new that... WWE is saddened to learn that WWE Hall of Famer... Harry Fujiwara, known to WWE fans as Mr. Fuji, passed away this morning at the age of 82. Let's see if I can find anything concerned on when they put him in the Hall of Fame. I'll look it up on his Wikipedia real quick. But obviously, you know, Mr. Fuji is known, like he said, as a legendary manager. One of the things I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention was the fantastic, fantastic parody, Fuji Vice. Yeah, with him and Don Morocco. I'm looking at the video right here. I don't have the best memory, but yeah, they both looking at the camera. Awesome.
I remember one of the... He actually wrestled at one of the WrestleManias, WrestleMania 5. He was the third tag team partner for the Powers of Pain in a handicap match against Demolition. Do you remember, have you ever seen that?
No, I think that was before my time and that kind of match. Yeah. No offense, Daza, I'm not going to go out of my way to watch Mr. Fuji in a match.
It was quite the, because we used to have a gimmick where we would do, where we would have a, with the managers, we would have like sort of the, like a tag team where there'd be like a tag team feud with one of the managers. And eventually the manager will be interfering. And eventually the big payoff was that they will basically get like either a handicap match or a triple threat match. Cause they did it at WrestleMania 3 with Dangerous Danny Davis and the British Bulldogs and the Hart Foundation. We did it at WrestleMania 4 with, the Islanders and the British Bulldogs where they had Bobby Heenan, sort of in the tag match. I remember they did it at WrestleMania 5, I think it was, where basically, basically, the powers of pain, their manager had to basically face off against Demolition. And they would do the thing where the manager would just come in and just sort of like, he'd tag in when the other wrestler was down and everything. So he'd basically go in, hit a few blows and then like tag out. But eventually the faces would get a hold of him and everything. So, but yeah, I remember that. But yeah, it's very sad news about Mr. Fuji. Yeah,
he went in the WWE Hall of Fame March 31st, 2007. So. He is, in fact, a WWE Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
So it's funny, when we were pitching ideas back and forth for this week's show as far as all things news are concerned, it's like, well, we don't have that much really this week, so we'll just do a couple of news stories and then we'll go right into Slate. Then this thing falls in our lap. So,
oh, dear.
I guess turning what's called turning bad news into good news is what we do here on Tales from the Couch Zone. Right, let's move on to our normal.
I'll keep an eye on Twitter as well, just in case we get any quotes or anything from any wrestlers.
Okay,
in
excellent.
Tribute to him.
There you go. All right, let's go into our regularly scheduled program. Dazza, you brought up my attention. I haven't investigated this so far. Educate our audience and me. What's this news about this new Transformers movie?
Yeah. Basically, I think that the Michael Bay, the makers of the Transformers film, are basically just like trolling us now. I think they realize that these films just make so much money that they can basically just, I think they're actually testing just how ridiculous they can make these films and people still keep going to see them. The plot for the latest Transformers film, which will be Transformers 5, last night, and immediately when they mentioned that sort of, the poster for this new film last night as shows Optimus Prime with like an old fashioned, Excalibur type sword and everything. So it's got speculation going and everything. And it seems that the story is going to be that Optimus Prime, in order to rebuild Cybertron, returns to Earth and goes back in time.
Oh, geez.
To the days of King Arthur.
Oh, Dazza, no.
to track down an artifact, which is endued with magic by Merlin himself.
is this confirmed by anybody, or is this?
This is confirmed.
Is it confirmed?
There has been, photos and footage, see, because we're filming it in Scotland. And there's basically been footage of guys on, like, horseback in sort of, like, you know, Dark Ages type Atia, and yeah, this is confirmed.
This sounds preposterous.
Yeah, and also it makes no sense because the whole, I know we've gone past the whole sort of robots in disguise thing, but what, you know, Optimus Prime and all the Transformers, and you would imagine all the Autobots and Decepticons, they're all going to be still in their they're like, you know, 21st century vehicle modes. So they're basically going to go over like, you know, the Scottish Highlands as trucks and cars and stuff like that. It's just to give my history of the Transformer movies. The first one I actually liked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a fun action film. They didn't have too many other Transformers, but they all sort of like, you know, I think we're like pretty much splitting like, you know, teams of five. So you had some good battle scenes. The stories with the human element were fine. It all worked. Transformers 2 was an absolute mess. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just absolutely awful. There was too much of the humans, but there was really, really bad comedy. It just became, you know, a really, really awful film. You had that stupid, like, you know, Devastator with the, you know, with the testicles and everything. It was just a complete mess. The third one, I didn't think it wasn't great, but I didn't think it was too bad. It was just, you know, it was okay. you know, the fourth one, Age of Extinction, I think is one of the worst films ever made. and that's a film that includes the Dinobots, which is the thing that we all wanted to see. We all wanted to see the Dinobots. And then we sort of like, the actual Transformers 4 was just absolutely horrible, horrible film. Just a mess on every level. I mean, it's amazing that they managed to, throughout these films, actually managed to make Optimus Prime into a complete and utter murdering psycho. in the fourth one, I don't know if you ever see it, he actually uses a cannon to kill Kelsey Grammer. He actually, you know, the whole thing about Optimus Prime, he actually shoots a human with his big, massive, fuck off bazooka, laser gun, whatever it is. It's just, you know, and now we've got this, oh God, it's, I've got to say, I've basically, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me four times, it's my own fault. I'm not going to say this. Unless the reviews are so stellar saying it's turned everything around, this film looks, you know, great, I'm not going to say this film. Okay. I just can't. I mean, the last one was when it was like Optimus Prime, like suddenly flying off into the stars and everything. That final scene, I remember I just thought, no more. I'm done.
Yeah, and previously thought Dazza, I don't know where you're getting your news from. You're not giving me a news source, but I'm looking at here right now at Nerdist.com, and they back up everything you say. Yeah. So let's say this winds up being bogus. Well, at least we have sources like the Nerdist to blame. These are and it's not like Nerdist is a fly-by-night website that no one's ever heard of. This is pretty, like, almost the website to go to as far as all things movie and television are concerned for all things nerd. So, yeah. We have a source, and if this winds up being a hoax, they're to blame.
But yeah, but the other up to now, the other stuff that they've been sort of showing, because we're still, because of the even though it's got like a medieval thing to it, because of like the sales they make from all the sort of, you know, endorsements and everything by having sort of certain cars turned into the robots, they're still doing, you know, the new robots and everything. They've created some weird little scooter-like robot, which basically looks like they're trying to go for the for something which is going to be like cute that the kids all like. You know, like BB-8 in Force Awakens.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got this like little blue, I think they call it Skeeter or something like that. Look, basically, everything about these films looks, you know, dreadful. And I know they sort of, you know, but what annoys me is people, you know, they're still going to make $1 billion.
Yeah, no doubt.
With these films, because normally what you get, and you see it with the Marvel movies, with the Avengers, you know, the first Avengers film, you know, did massive numbers, and then the second one did as well, but it didn't do as much as the first one. It dropped off somewhere. These get stronger with each film.
Yeah,
you know, they started off with like the 700 million, went up to 9, then they reached the billion. But Age of Extinction did a little bit less than the third one.
I think that's why it's been so long since the last Transformers film came out. Yeah,
but it still did over $1 billion.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but you know, it's still, and the thing is, if you look, this Transformer film comes out next year. And then there's one a year later in 2018, and then another one in 2019. It's never going to end.
No,
people are still going to keep going seeing. And then everyone's going to sit and complain about, oh, come on, you know, you never get any new ideas any time. It's because none of you are going to see these films with new ideas.
Well, it's more so, why do they keep making these bad Transformer movies? And it's because people like you keep going. It's like, yeah, you may watch it and think it's a horrible movie, but at the end of the day, you're going there and you're supporting it with your money. So you can't sit there and say, oh, I can't imagine why they're making all these bad Transformer films and not trying to make something better. But you're part of the problem if you go and pay to see these films, because you're just encouraging them to make more films like this.
Well, my conscience will be clear after this one. I'm just wondering how, if Michael Bay, you know, because he's basically got this little like fetish for getting lingerie models to dress up in sort of you know, students and everything for his sort of, like, his little sort of fantasy things that he has about women. I'm just wondering if he's going to have sort of like lots of sort of like lingerie models dressed as like medieval wenches and stuff, mm-hmm. all dancing and stuff like that. You see, there's going to be loads of arse shots, I'm sure, so we managed to squeeze all that in there. But yeah, I just saw the, I just saw, you know, because the thing is, it's one of these things that, I don't want to be one of these people that basically sees like a slight clip of something or a plot and just goes, oh God, this is going to be so awful. I like to be, you know, positive and think, you know, well, maybe we've got an idea and everything. But with the Transformers, so many people want these films to be good. You know, because I was basically a Transformer fan. I have the toys. I love the comic. But, you know, the 1986, I think it was, cartoon movie, I absolutely love. You know, I've got it on DVD and I'll put it in from time to time, like, you know, just sort of, you know, with the, you know, just a fun film. But, you know, these films, you know, you want them to be good, but they're just not. And it's sort of, it's almost as if they sort of try to do stuff that is going to make them even more embarrassing. It's like, you know, this thing that Michael Bay seems to have of designing Transformers so that they have like beer bellies, you know, and testicles and things. It's just like, you know, I don't know.
Well, let's transition. We're down this new Transformer film. I feel like being a lot more positive. Something that I'm oddly excited about that I really shouldn't be, all things considered. But Dazza, let's talk Guardians.
Guardians, yes. This looks. I want to see this film. This looks great to me. It's basically a Russian version of the Avengers.
And I think you're giving it too much credit. It seems like a gigantic step down from the Avengers.
No, well, I said it's their version of the Avengers. their answer to the Avengers. And it's just, it's like this, like a superhero movie with sort of like, you know, a Russian theme to it and everything, all done on a budget of $5 million. I'm guessing that $5 million in the film industry in Russia buys a lot more than it would in America, because you couldn't make a romantic comedy on $5 million. But yeah, I just watch it and I just think this film, I really hope this film gets a distribution deal, you know, overseas, so we can see it in cinemas and stuff, because there's a lot of cool sort of looking foreign films that unless you just happen to be in a sort of like near an art house cinema that happens to just show it, you don't get to see, because Japan has got a new Godzilla movie out at the moment, which, you know, it probably won't be able to see on at the cinema. There was a Attack on Titan, which was a live-action version of a really good anime season that basically got made, and that never sort of made its way to cinema. So I would actually love this to come, because I love watching foreign films generally. And because they have sort of like, even if it's just something, it's like a refreshing look and change to like your normal Hollywood films. You know, there's many films. There was a... and I forgot what the film's called, but there was a Korean, you might be able to help me out, because it was a horror film. It was a Korean horror film a few years ago. It was almost like a Korean version of a Godzilla movie. And I'm guessing you've no idea what I'm talking about.
I'm blanking on the name, but Dazza, as always, I have my Google machine going. Yeah? And let's see, was it Pulgasri?
Is no, that... it wasn't that one. It was a more recent one.
Oh, okay.
I left.
Yeah, that's a 1985 film.
Can't figure this one out. But it was watching foreign movies and their take on fantasy and sort of horror and sci-fi. So sometimes you get some the different feel to it and the look of it. You know, it can be sort of like, you know, really, really refreshing. But there was a Russian film, there was two of them. I think there was one called Day Watch and one called Night Watch. And they were, you know, they were sort of like horror fantasy films. And they just had like, you know, a different vibe to them, you know, which were really good. So I personally, I hope this film gets to, you know, gets into cinemas. Basically, if nothing else, for the fact that you've got a giant bear with a machine gun.
With a Gatling gun. I remember I saw that on all the news, I guess sort of the geeky nerdy sites. It'd be like, there's a guy with the bear for a head and they gave him a Gatling gun. And if you think I'm exaggerating or think I'm being a little, you know, over the top, it's exactly what it is, and it's as awesome as you imagine it to be, if not more so.
Yeah, and it, look, and it's a different feel to it as well, because rather than sort of having endless films about sort of like, you know, a big space battle in New York, this one's you know, set in Moscow, and it just looks, you know, to me it just looks, you know, a refreshing, you know, change of pace. The film I was trying to refer to was the film called The Host.
Oh, I'm familiar with that movie. I've seen that. I haven't seen the entire movie, but I've seen clips and bits of it, and I've seen the trailer. Yeah, that's a cool looking movie.
It is. It's one of those, because basically they've got like a, not quite a Godzilla creature, but it's sort of like this creature. It's I think it's about the size of like an elephant or something, you know, that basically goes on this rampage. And the special effects, you know, look really good. You kind of sort of, you know, you're watching it and it's kind of, it's, you know, it's running around this thing. And it's one of those films that you can't really tell whether it's quite well, when I watched it, I couldn't tell if it was like CGI or, you know, or animatronics or something like that. But, you know, it was like, you know, a really cool film. So occasionally you'll get these little films that basically just sort of, you know, offer something different. But yeah, the Guardians, you know, I hope we get to see it. It looks, the battle scenes look really cool with them using the powers on the Russian tanks and everything like that. So, yeah, so we will see.
All right. That's going to do it for the news portion of the show. Usually this tends to go a lot quicker, but like you said, it was kind of a slow week for news. I guess we sort of, you know, I hate to say it because it's, you know, it's coming off of someone's death, but we managed to make some hay out of that. So let's move on to Rate and Slate for the films of 1988. I have it pulled up here at TKO170.com. Obviously, these are not the best reviewed films of the year. These are just based exclusively on box office. So let's start at number 10, Dazza. At number 10, we have Cocktail. Number 9, Big. Number 8, Die Hard. Number 7, Rambo 3. Number 6, A Fish Called Wanda. Number 5, Twins. Let's see, I'm losing my place here. Number 4, Crocodile Dundee 2. I didn't know there's a part 1. Number 3, ooh, ouch. I know when we get to our Rate and Slate, especially when we get to Rate, it's going to be hard to pick one because, man, this is an onslaught. Number 3, Coming to America. Number 2, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? And at number 1, Rain Man. Good luck, Dazza. I don't envy you. Good luck trying to pick one winner out of this bunch, because really, you got some stiff competition here. In fact, I'd say half these movies you could easily pick Rate, and I'd be like, yeah, Dazza's on board. Dazza, I can't disagree with that, because it's like, we got Die Hard and, you know, Coming to America and Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Rain Man. It's like, oh, even Twins to a degree. I don't think it's a horrible film, but at the same time, it's like, yeah, it's a fun film. Die Hard, oh, God. It's like Sophie's Choice here.
Yeah. I mean, out of this list.
Okay. I'm sorry. I don't mean to get ahead of myself, but there's other entries on this film that need to be addressed. At number 12, we have Oliver and Company. Number 13, Beetlejuice. Let's see what else we have on this year. Oh, God. There's so many good. Okay. Sorry, guys. I didn't mean to interrupt, but those were the two ones, yeah. Especially the Beetlejuice that caught my eye.
Yeah, I mean the one I'm really going to go for is Die Hard.
Okay, can't disagree with that.
As my Rate. Yeah, I mean it's just this one. I mean, I think if you ask a lot of people what their favorite, and I personally don't think this, but if you ask a lot of people what their favorite action film is, a lot of people will go for Die Hard. You know, and I think it's a great action film. And this is, at the time, action films were kind of, I think this one sort of like really, really excelled in a genre that was sort of becoming more and more like, generic and really boring. Cause your action films were all basically Stallone and Schwarzenegger. And if you sort of look at this sort of the ones that we've been sort of in the years before this, they were starting to look really, really old. In the sort of, you know, the films weren't, you know, were not good. Die Hard came along and it just offered you something different, because you had a character in there who was basically, he wasn't like the invincible superhero, but, you know, the sort of warrior. He was basically just a cop. You know, he was sort of, who basically just was in the wrong place at the wrong time. His whole thing would be, you know, for doing what he did was basically to save his wife. And it was, sort of like, you know, a self-contained sort of, filming, but everything happened in the building. So it was basically his sort of like, you know, battle up the stairs and everything and up the sort of the levels. And it was really surprising to me how good it was, because at the time, this was Bruce Willis's like breakout role. And Bruce Willis before this film wasn't basically known as a movie star. He was basically a TV star. And the TV show that it was like really, really famous on was a show called Moonlighting, which was a really fun detective show, which was also one of the shows that basically sort of the first ones I remember breaking the fourth wall, where Bruce Willis would actually talk to the audience and stuff like that. So it played around with stuff, but it wasn't a role that you would have thought this guy could be an action hero. And when you saw him as an action hero, you thought this isn't going to work. But the film, I personally think is, you know, a really great action movie, a hell of a lot of fun. And, you know, it's also as well, it's sort of kind of where you can sneak in as a Christmas movie as well.
I've seen people do that nowadays. First, it was kind of sort of tongue in cheek thing, but now I see people doing it on a regular basis, considering it a Christmas movie. I don't know if you're familiar with the animated show Cleveland Show, sort of a spinoff of Family Guy. I know of it.
I wasn't a fan.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm just saying I guess they did the gimmick of what's your favorite Christmas story, and the Cleveland characters all Die Hard too.
Yeah. and another thing as well is that Alan Rickman is absolutely amazing in this film. Mm-hmm. as the villain. He's one of those villains that is so funny as well. He basically sort of steals every scene that is in. It's just for me a really cool action movie, and I think it really broke the mold in action movies in some respects. And it's one that sort of, I think it, even today, it just sort of, you know, it stands the test of time. It is a really fun movie.
Okay. Let's see. There's so many to choose from. Like I said before, I'm pulled so many different directions, but if I have to be objective, my favorite film of all of these, it's really hard to say because I'm looking at it like literally the movie right above it, Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I'm like, oh, that one's so good too. But for me, it's got to be the Eddie Murphy classic Coming to America. That's a film that I think everybody should have to watch. Like, I think there was a generation, obviously. I think if you ask kids nowadays, I have to imagine at this point, they probably haven't seen the movie. But there was a good while where there was sort of like a rite of passage as far as from becoming I think they even show this on national television. This is sort of a thing that you watched in America, even as a kid. We obviously had to censor some of the jokes out, but this is something that you had to just watch. It was sort of an experience that everybody had at the same time. And it's sort of this film that as part of the, I guess you could say it's the American lexicon, but the fact that I'm here sitting doing the show with you, Dazza, an Englishman, it's like, okay, this is something that, you know, I guess maybe the Western world, it's kind of must have to watch because it's such an absolute classic. This is sort of, I guess you would say, Eddie Murphy's, I guess, masterpiece as it would be, because obviously he did stuff like Beverly Hills Cop, and that was a really big project for him. But to me, this was like this masterpiece, the film that I hate to say it because considering the way his career has played out, it was probably the peak of his career. Would you agree, Dazza?
Yeah, pretty much, because he did not do a great deal, you know, for after this. It has to be said. His career just sort of kind of, he went into more of a slap, you know, a really heavy, you know, slapstick comedy, shall we say, with all the, was it the Flumps?
That does sound like an Eddie Murphy movie that he did not too long ago. But yeah, obviously there's films like here, like I want to go on off and on about Coming to America, but really, like I said, it was really hard for me to pick stuff. Die Hard, I could have easily gone that direction. Absolutely classic of a action film. I could have easily, like I said, gone with Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Another great movie, obviously, is Rain Man. Obviously, not my cup of tea, but I can appreciate the greatness of a film that is. Another freaking classic that you have to watch if you're, I would say of a certain generation, but really if you're like a millennial or something, or you're just like, I guess you're a teenager, or even if you're like a kid, you can watch this movie and it's stood the test of time, and it's an absolute classic. It's a fun film that everybody should check out. I already know.
I have to say that I was actually torn between Die Hard and Big because Big is, and Tom Hanks is absolutely hilarious in this film, because basically, if you don't know the story, he starts off as a kid who basically sort of goes to one of these like make-a-wish machines, and he basically just asks, I want to be big, and then the next morning he wakes up and he's basically an adult. But the thing is, he plays the part so great in the fact he basically takes on all the mannerisms of a kid. Even like the way that he walks and the way that he runs and stuff, he's just absolutely, because somebody actually made this point at the time, because why it is that sort of, you know, serious roles always get like the Oscar nominations and stuff like that. But as an actor, you know, sometimes you have a comedy role that basically it's basically really difficult that you have to step up for. And Tom Hanks, that was a really tough role to basically, you know, play off. Because there's been a lot of films like that where they have this sort of like the kid all grown up sort of thing. And they never quite were. But Tom Hanks made it really, really work. And I absolutely, you know, love Big. I think it's an absolutely hilarious film. And again, that's one that sort of, you know, still stands the test of time today, the humor in it and everything.
Yeah, like I said, it's a classic that everybody should have to watch at some point in their lives. This is going to be hard, because I'm looking at this list as far as our next segment, Slate, and I think I know what you're going to pick, and it seems like a low-hanging fruit, but at the same time, it's like I may be surprised.
I think I will surprise you, actually. The one I'm going to pick is actually a British film, and it's called A Fish Called Wanda.
Okay. This is obviously another film that I haven't seen before, so I really can't say one way or another whether it's good or bad.
Yeah, it's basically a British comedy, and it's one of those films that because the British film industry is not exactly, shall we say, consistent. Occasionally you'll get like, you know, a couple of films that sort of like, you know, but just really, really excel and get people excited. But generally speaking, it's not sort of, you know, it's nowhere near on the par of pulling out, let's say, the fan favorite hits like, you know, the American. So, and Fish Called Wanda was one of these films that came on. Everybody was raving about it, how funny it was and everything. And it had, John Cleese in it, Michael Palin, who were two of the Monty Pythons. And it was one of these films that I just don't find it funny at all. John Cleese stopped being funny after Monty Python came to, after the Meaning of Life, anything aside from Fawlty Towers or Monty Python, he basically, anything he's tried to do which is supposed to be funny just isn't. You know, it's just not funny. And this film, I remember sort of watching it once, and I just did not get the gags at all. And I'm actually surprised that it was sort of, I'm looking at the actual the breakdowns of it, and I think it basically it did 63 million in the in America, and then did 126 million worldwide. So it was obviously basically, you know, one of these films that sort of meant more in like the UK and the European markets, that sort of thing, but it did in America. But it's not a it's one of those films that I just really didn't get. You know, the humor in it. It's just not funny and just sort of really boring. And so that would be the one that I would slate in there. For me, it's not. I know you probably thought I was going to pick Rambo 3 or something like that, but yeah, a fish called one. It's kind of, and it's, but I think one thing that gets me about it is the fact that it's still today. It's when people do like the top. The top UK films of all time, or the top comedies of all time, it always finds its way in there, and I just don't get it at all.
Yeah, obviously, like I said, this has happened before in the past where I can't really pick one. Obviously, Rambo 3 seems like low-hanging fruit, but at the same time, I've never seen the film. And I tend to have lower standards, considering I'm such a big horror fan. So who's to say maybe it's you know, Stallone, and I may like it. I can sort of justify it. a one that seems like a no-brainer, but I'll admit I like it. It's sort of a guilty pleasure. I like Twins. Maybe I'm the exception. Daz, are you a big fan of Twins?
I can watch Twins. I think it's that film's got quite a bit of charm to it, because I think that's the first time that Schwarzenegger did something that wasn't an action film.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, and the thing is, he sort of like plays like a sweet, you know, lovable guy in it. Danny DeVito's great anyway, you know, so he basically carries the sort of, you know, he carries the comedy on everything. It's like the bit where I always remember this bit where they basically, it turns out that they were twins who were part of his sort of experiment and that Schwarzenegger was basically the one who he was all the sort of the best of, you know, he was like, you know, he got the best body and everything like that. He was part of the, you know, the experiment. And Danny DeVito seems to think that that means that he got the brains of it. It turns out that basically Danny DeVito was basically all the fat and all the leftover from the actual, you know, from, you know, he was basically all that was left. It was just made into like a person and everything. So you know, that's the film. It's not a film I got my way to watch, but it's not when I saw it, I thought it was fine. You know,
go ahead.
It was, you know, an 80s comedy and it was, you know, perfectly fine and perfectly watchable. I thought it was fine at the time.
Am I imagining this, or did they tease at the end of the movie that there was a third brother?
I don't remember that.
Because I remember I listened to an interview with Arnold Schwarzenegger on Howard Stern, and he sort of teased that their original idea for the film was that they would tease that there was a third brother. And you know who it was, Dazza, since we were talking about it not too long ago? Do you know who that third brother was supposed to be?
No. Who would that be?
Eddie Murphy. sort of playing off the gimmick, it's like the idea that Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito are twins. It's like, let's take it even further and let's have Eddie Murphy be the third twin.
Okay, I've just Googled this, uh-huh. And apparently, and this is only from last year. apparently, they are still talking about doing this film. They are still talking about doing triplets, and it says the twin sequel, currently titled Triplets, would bring Eddie Murphy in as co-star with Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito.
That'd be great.
that yeah. But what, why not?
maybe for different reasons, but it'd be great.
Yeah. So, yeah, we'll see on that one. Right.
Okay, we're moving on to Best Picture for 1988. Obviously, because they always do the gimmick the year after Best Picture. Obviously, I mentioned earlier the number one performing film, Rain Man.
Ah, right, okay.
Yeah, you certainly can't fault them with that. All right. From here we got.
Can I just ask who that year did who got the best actor?
Let me look this up very quickly, Dazzle. 1989, best actor. Let's see, Dustin Hoffman, obviously for the previously mentioned Rain Man.
Yeah.
Shocker there, right?
I thought I remembered him, you know, gaining it for that. I just wanted to be sure. But yeah, again, that's a great film.
Okay. You know. Since we're talking the best of the best, let's talk the worst of the worst now, Dazza. We talked the Academy Awards. Let's talk the 9th annual Golden Razzie Awards for the films of 1988. For worst picture, as we always do, I list all the titles and Dazza tries to guess which one of these five films won worst picture. Starting at number one, Hot to Trot by Warner Brothers. Number two, Caddyshack 2 from Warner Brothers as well. From Touchstone, we have Cocktail. From Orion, we have Mac and Me. And from TriStar, we have Rambo 3. Now, Dazza, which of these three films is the worst film, according to the Razzies, for 1988?
I would have thought from that film, because it's quite notorious, I would have thought Mac and Me.
That would be incorrect, Dazza. Care to guess again, or do you want to just throw in the towel?
Rambo 3?
No, Dazza.
Okay, I'll give it. Which one was it?
Next week, I gotta get bells and whistles, because we gotta make this part of the act. But, no, the Touchstone film Cocktail, which I've never actually heard of. Let's look this up very quickly. Oh, that's not fair. I'm looking at it now. It's like, oh, wait, now I recognize it. That's not fair. That's mean. This is, I noticed, and I, Go ahead.
I don't get this one.
I think what we're seeing in the early ages of the Razzies, this is sort of their way to complain about popular films. Because really, come on, Cocktail for the worst film of 1988?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a great movie, but it's perfectly, there's nothing really horrible about it.
It's not a cinema classic, but at the same time, it's like, really, that's what you're going to rail as the worst movie? Like I said, I think this is sort of this is before the age of the internet. This was a lot of people's only venue to complain about movies, and really, you would have to. Yeah, because I'm looking at Worst Actor, and one of the nominees is Tom Cruise in Cocktail. It's like, okay, now you're just being spiteful.
I do think, if we sort of look down the list, and I think we've noticed that there's certain years that there's certain people that they've had it in for. So, like, for example, Madonna, Stallone. So, and I think looking back to the 80s, at this period, Tom Cruise was one of those guys that at this time, he was sort of in. It was one of those characters that you were basically getting sick of seeing because he was basically like, you know, a really, really big star. And it just seemed to be one of these things that there was always a Tom Cruise film coming out, you know, constantly. And it was always almost like the same role every single time, you know, and it was sort of, so I think sometimes with these Razzies that they're basically, it's kind of they're sort of showing, kind of like their disapproval of certain, like, you know, actors or directors or whatever, who basically they thought we were seeing way too much of, or we were basically seeing that they were basically sort of outstaying their welcome somewhat.
These awards, you know, especially this year, and we've seen in other years, they just come off as kind of catty. It's like, oh, let's just pick on so-and-so because we can. And it's like, okay, that's not really fair. You're not really being objective there. But at the same time, you have to go for the big films. You have to go for the big movie stars. Because if you're being objective, the worst film is probably some low-budget film from some third-bit studio that you've never heard of. And to me, that's no fun. The idea, I guess, of the Razzies is to sort of be catty, like I said previously. But to me, this is just being spiteful.
I think with the Razzies, I think they always... it always had to be a film from a big studio, you know, to sort of qualify. So they wouldn't basically have some sort of like little independent film on a really, really small budget and everything. It had to be sort of like a studio that basically made these films. I mean, looking at the list, I mean, Mac and Me is, that film's just, have you ever seen that film?
Let's see, I'm looking at, no, I've
never. It's hilarious because it's basically, it's basically one big giant commercial for, I mean, it's basically, for, I mean, if you can't guess from the title, it's actually funded by McDonald's.
Really? Cause I would look at this and be like, oh, this is clearly an E.T. ripoff.
It is. It's an E.T. ripoff. Mm-hmm. But it was basically sort of like, you know, it was basically funded by McDonald's.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm seeing.
It was
I'm
pretty much a propaganda piece for sort of drinking and eating fast food.
Ah.
You know, there's sort of, I think there's the, one of the scenes, and apparently the sort of, I think the alien sort of needs like to drink Coca-Cola to live or something like that. There's like so much product placement in this film. It's absolutely, you know, hilarious. It's, and that's, you know, that's what basically I think why it is, apart from it being a really, really bad E.T. ripoff, is it was basically one which was just a complete and utter, you know, propaganda piece for to get kids into basically buying Big Macs and Coca-Cola and stuff like that. So it's kind of like a really sort of, you know, dodgy film in that respect. And Rambo 3 is the film that we mentioned before that you don't see on TV very much nowadays because it was basically a film that pretty much had Rambo teaming up with the Taliban.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, which granted, in those days, this was set in Afghanistan, so this was basically when, you know, this sort of, you know, the enemy was sort of, you know,
got
Russia.
So he
basically teams up with the Taliban to fight, you know, the Russian invader sort of thing. But obviously nowadays, that's not going to fly with audiences. I think I could be wrong on this, but I think that there's some sort of... there's some sort of dedication to the brave men and women of the, I don't think it mentions Taliban, but it's pretty much.
It'd be great if it did.
I don't think it goes that way, but it basically sort of, there is like a tribute to the sort of the freedom fighters of Afghanistan who basically were, you know, pretty much, you know, morphed into the Taliban. So, yeah, I'm just looking on the Wikipedia page. It says it was, it's been, yeah, there's been some sort of cuts to the film, so I'm guessing they've basically changed things around to something. But yeah,
I can't imagine why. Yeah,
dedicated to the brave Mujahideen fighters.
Whoa!
But this was later changed to dedicated to the gallant people of Afghanistan. Not the ones that sort of helped Bin Laden, it should probably says.
I'm sure my resident libertarian will discuss all things not interfering with... With other nations. I'm sure he'll trumpet this film.
It's one of his films. But that was actually supposed at one point we were talking about doing a Rambo film, I think. Because we did the John Rambo film. At one point we were talking about after 9/11, we're doing like a Rambo film where he basically sort of, you know, goes back into Afghanistan to fight Bin Laden. And the so
I will say this. There are worse ideas than that.
Well,
I'm not saying it's a great idea, but I'm saying there are worse ideas out there. I'm just saying going back in the Wayback Machine at the time, that may have been sort of, obviously it wouldn't have been a cinematic classic or anything, but really it may have been something that, you know, as a nation, especially us in America, would have maybe attached to a degree.
Just speak on that. Have you ever noticed that you don't really get that many films where the sort of where groups like Al Qaeda are the enemy? You know, because for example, I'm just throwing this out of it. In the recent James Bond films, Daniel Craig one, you would have thought that sort of like, you know, a group like Al Qaeda would have basically been like, you know, the perfect villain to base something on. They never actually do that. It's always like some sort of like secret corporation, which is basically manipulating the terrorist groups for their own ends. They never go out. In the James Bond film, you've never had an all-out, you know, because during the Cold War, it was basically like, you know, the Russians were, you know, the enemy. You've never had sort of like a James Bond film, for example, anything like that, where the villain was the an Al Qaeda group. It's always like the sort of like the government basically sort of like, you know, using them as patsies or something like that.
That's just not cool. It's not sexy. The idea of James Bond versus the Taliban. It's like, it's like, what casinos is he going to go to? It's like, you know what I mean?
Well, you could sort of, you could sex it up somehow.
When he goes to Saudi Arabia? That wouldn't be bad, actually, now that I think about it.
But I mean, sort of, if you think, you know, what the big threat, you know, would be to for a British secret agent would be fighting nowadays, you know, it would be sort of like, you know, suicide bombers wanting to cause a terrorist attack on British or American soil.
Yeah, but, and then you could always do the gimmick, because obviously with the James Bond thing, it always has to be James Bond preventing the thing that's gonna would decimate the world, and you could do like the terrorists are gonna get their hands on a nuclear device. You could do something like that, I guess. It'd be interesting.
You don't think it's because they're not they don't want the sort of the backlash?
No, because I've seen several films where, you know, they never go into the specifics on what terrorist group it is, but it's always, you know, the terrorist group from the Middle East, and it's, you know, they never go into specifics, but I've seen that before, Daz. I've seen that foil before. Mm-hmm.
Oh.
You're not sold on the idea.
I'm not. No, I'm sort of. I think if he had a James Bond film where the being very careful here, where the villains were an ISIS type group or something like that, there would basically be sort of some sort of backlash against it for stereotyping, basically. But that's just my opinion.
No, there's probably some truth to that. Now that I think about it, Daza. Okay. Did you still want to run down the other, obviously we went off worst picture. We normally go down the worst actor, worst actress
bring them up.
For worst actor, we have Sylvester Stallone again, Rambo 3 as John Rambo. Liz Minnelli, I don't know why they have her listed like that, but in Arthur 2 on the Rocks and Rent-A-Cop, I guess they give them to those respectively. Although I find their wording cute, because they put respectively worst actress.
I think that's a bit unfair.
Yeah, I know.
I've seen Alpha 2. It's not, compared to Alpha 1, it's not good, but it has its moments. There's a few funny bits in, but I think that's, you know. Caddyshack 2, by the way, was, just going back to that list, Caddyshack 2 was pretty poor, sequel. Have you ever seen that?
I haven't seen part two, no. In fact, I've heard nothing but bad things.
It basically does not have Rodney Dangerfield in it. They basically change the actor.
Boo.
And it's a poor substitute. But it's very much more slapstick than the original Caddyshack.
That's what I've heard. Yeah. So I'm glad I sort of had that confirmed. But yeah, it's
and Chevy Chase really phones it in.
Yeah. I can imagine that's probably part of the course. In fact, one of the I think worst supporting actor is Dan Aykroyd in Caddyshack 2.
That's for damn sure. his part in it is absolutely awful.
Now I'm looking over this, and the one that sort of catches my eye for worst new star, you'll never guess who it is, Dazza, in Mac and Me.
I'm guessing it's somebody who, was it somebody who basically went on to be quite good?
No.
It's a
corporate figure, to be honest. It's not it's a fictional person.
Oh, is it Ronald McDonald?
Yeah, as himself.
I told you. It is basically it's got Ronald McDonald. It is basically a propaganda piece for McDonald's.
And I will say this, I have a problem with this list. I'm looking at the nominees for Worst New Star. Jean-Claude Van Damme in Bloodsport? Wrong! Film's great, Dazza.
Speaking of which, have you seen the...
JVD?
No, the trailer for the new Jean-Claude Van Damme
film. No, I have not. Is it bad?
Should I go out of my way?
What's that? It is?
It looks awesome. It's... Oh God! It's coming out. It's got Dave Bautista in it as the main bad guy. It looks like,
mm-hmm.
And it's basically got Jean-Claude Van Damme in it as basically. So it seems more like a cameo. It's basically it's Kickboxer Vengeance. You know the Kickboxer movies that he did. This is kind of a new movie. It's also got Georges St-Pierre in it.
Awesome!
Cain Velasquez, and it's basically. Stop me if you've heard this one before. The the plot of it is that basically you've got a kickboxer. You basically got a sort of a young lad who's his friend is basically enters a kickboxing tournament, like a sort of like an underground one, and he gets killed by Dave Bautista. So he trains to be a fighter to go for revenge to face him. But the you've got to watch the trailer. The trailer, it looks fun as hell. And at the end, when it shows you, like, you know, the big fight that's going to happen, it's basically they have Dave Bautista has his gloves with basically glass in them. you know, like the ECW matches with Axel Ian Rotten.
Mm-hmm.
When yeah, it's that sort of deal.
Oh, may have to watch this film then.
Yeah. So this is coming. I think it's coming out either this month or next month. But I'm going to have to see this. But Jean-Claude Van Damme is basically like the trainer. Sort of like training the young lad to basically sort of be to face Bautista.
When really, in fact, it probably wouldn't take that much to beat a big Dave Bautista.
Well, seeing what his actual MMA fight was like, no. Not that I'm casting any aspersions, but
are we going to incur the wrath of one Dave Bautista? Am I going to have to look behind, watch my back when I'm walking down the street? Should one Dave Bautista decide to beat me up?
I'll buy him some lunchboxes. Some lunchboxes at the class. But that fight looked fake to me.
Okay.
I've got this. Basically because the guy seems to tag Dave Bautista and he gets rocked. And it was almost as if Bautista basically takes him down. It almost was as if he just went down really, really easy. It was almost as if he was basically meant to take a dive and then sort of like thought, oh shit, I've just hitting to make a fight and make for, oh God, I've hurt him. It just was one of those fights. It just, I mean, the other guy could, he looked like a really bad fighter as well. So it could just be my imagination. But to me, it looked like it was kind of a few shenanigans going on to me.
There you go. All right, Deza. What have you, listen, since we're talking movies, have you watched anything as of late? I noticed you, maybe, I think you posted something on Facebook earlier this week.
Yeah, I've not been to the cinema. I actually tried to go to the cinema to see Bad Moms, and it was sold out, which really surprised me. I didn't think it would be sold out. So I've not been to cinema, but I've seen a film, which I don't think is actually out in the US yet. It's, it's an independent film called The Lobster.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of this one?
No, I'm not. It sounds vaguely familiar, but
you may want to sit down when you hear what the story is.
Oh dear.
Okay, it's basically an independent movie, very much an art house type movie. Mm-hmm. It's a black comedy. It is funny. The plot of it is that this is set in a world where it's illegal to be single. So,
oh dear, Daza.
Yeah. Basically, me and you are fucked. but it gets me and you and Edwin, San Antonio. We'd be in trouble.
What are you talking about? He's dating Paige Van Zandt. That's what he tells me. And I don't think Ed would lie to me.
well, she took a photo with him. So that's
confirmed. Confirmed.
That must mean that she likes him. but anyway, going back to the lobster, it's illegal to, in this world, it's illegal to be single. So if you are given so long to find a mate to basically have a relationship and get married to, and if you don't, you are basically surgically turned into an animal.
Hey, it's worse than being dead, Daza.
Yeah,
there are worse fates in this world.
And so basically the animal that this guy chooses, it's basically that if he basically fails to find a lover, is that he will be turned into a lobster.
Is he a rock lobster, Daza?
Sorry?
Is he a rock lobster?
Well, you have to see the film and find out.
you will neither confirm or deny whether or not he's turned into a rock lobster.
Yeah, but it's one of these, it is, like I said, very much an art house film. And I was going into this expecting that it was going to be a film that I hated, but it's played, straight. It is really funny in places because it's an art film. There's certain bits of it that basically go on, way too long. And there's certain segments of it where you start to get bored. But the overall thing of it is quite funny in places, it's actually got a good cast as well. It's got Colin Farrell in the lead role, Rachel Weisz is in it. It's got the, and I have to admit, I forgot the guy's name, but the guy who played Q in the latest James Bond films, the young lad, he's in it. It's got a good cast, and it's got basically a satire on relationships and people's need to be in relationships and desperations at time. And it sort of does some really clever things. I mean, one of the things is that they have to go to a hotel, and we're basically at this hotel, they're basically indoctrinated in the importance of being in a relationship. And they have to, they have to find a mate in a month. But there's also like a resistance group of single people that he sort of joins, and they basically have this sort of thing where you can't have a relationship with anybody, otherwise you get punished. So it's like the two extremes. You've got the one where you've got to be single, and the other way you've got to be in a relationship. And there are some really funny moments when basically the people get turned into animals and stuff. It's one of these films that if you actually see it, it just works as a black comedy. So that's basically the main film that I've seen. And although it's not a film that I basically 100% say I absolutely love, it is a film that I would sort of, recommend. It's got a good moments in it. And it's one of those films that if I'd have basically been, doing my film studies at the time of this film came out, I would have basically had a loads of things I could have wrote about it, because it's like, a really clever satire. And another film that I saw, which is quite, this is going to surprise you, because I was looking through Amazon Prime for something to watch. I didn't realize that I've never actually seen this film. For the first time, I saw Mad Max.
You're kidding.
No, it was something I've
wow, seen. Wow, talk about sequel. A late slip.
Yeah, I've seen all the sequels. I've seen Mad Max 2, Beyond Thunderdome. I've seen the new one. And I just realized as I was looking through it that I've never actually seen the first one. And I really enjoyed it. It was different from all the others because it's on a really, really small budget. So they don't go into the big post-apocalyptic world which is over top like the other do. Yeah, that society's starting to break down, and because it's set in Australia, because we've got the wonderful sort of like, you know, the wonderful landscape and the sort of, you know, desert and everything, they will be able to basically do like a more sort of like, you know, run down society, you know, on the brink as opposed to basically being totally devastated. And they had some like, you know, really good car stunts and car chases and everything. And it's one of those things that it's a small budget film, but that sort of worked in its favor because that gave it like a really, really, just a really sort of like, you know, different tone, you know, to the movie, you know, and I really enjoyed it. It actually got me thinking because, I don't know a great deal about the Australian film industry, but throughout the years, there has been some like really, really good, you know, Australian movies. And I think I'm actually going to have to collate these and put them into an article at some point. Because, you know, the sort of like really, really cult films that I think people aren't really aware of but would sort of enjoy. There's a really good one called Ghosts of the Civil Dead, which is a film set in a prison, and is a really good one. There's a film called Romper Stomper, which had Russell Crowe in a really early role. He plays a neo-Nazi in a skinhead group. There's a film as well, and I can't remember the name of it. I think it's called Malcolm, and it's basically it's about a young kid who is kind of autistic. He's got some sort of like condition. I think he's like autistic, but he's got this really, you know, he's a genius for basically making mechanical contraptions and things and stuff. And he ends up befriending this ex thief who's just got out of prison, and together they basically sort of plan to rob to do a series of bank robberies by using this kid's contraption. So they're using like remote control cars and everything like that. And it's just like a really, you know, good comedy. I'm pretty sure it's called Malcolm. I'll have to check that. But again, it's sort of, you know, the Australian, you know, film industry. It's sort of, they're sort of like, you know, low budget films, but just sort of like really, really good ones. And again, it's what we talked about earlier. They have a different feel to them than your sort of, than your Hollywood movies. You know, they have a sort of like, a bit more, you know, sort of creativity to them. And of course, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, which I absolutely love. And I think has got one of the most amazing, beautiful scenes ever when they've got the scene where one of them's on the bridge with this big flowing silver outfit and is basically sort of singing opera. It's just one of the most astounding scenes in a film I've ever seen. So I'm probably going to have to do like some sort of just a little article just listing some of the top Australian films, because basically it's got a really, you know, fun, you know, creative, you know, vibe to them, which I think, you know, people will sort of enjoy if they fancy, you know, looking out for something different. And I also saw, just final thing, I saw the pilot for the Tick TV show.
Oh, how's that? Because that's something I'm on the fence on. I'm like, I've never been a big fan of the Tick. I know that people are going to come at me with pitchforks and torches, but never been a big fan of the Tick. Obviously, I watched it as a kid, and I've since gone back, and I'm like, yeah, I'm not getting a lot of this humor. But I think that there was, I guess, a recent, I wouldn't say recent, but maybe like 10 years ago, there was a live action adaptation of that, and that was okay. So I'm curious, how was the pilot?
Yeah, I mean, I know what you're saying. I've never been big on the Tick. The cartoon never really appealed to me. I saw a few episodes of that TV show that you talked about in the past, and I personally did not like it. You know, I didn't like that at all. This pilot, I mean, it's worth checking out. I think it's only about like 20 minutes, and it's got potential. Let's say that the world that it sets of the superhero things and everything and the comedy, it looks like it, you know, it could have some legs, this one. And the actual, the Tick character, because basically when he appears, he's a superhero, but he's a bit of a buffoon. But the scene when he comes up and basically starts fighting all these bad guys, it was all done really, really well. you know, and really funny because he's basically this indestructible guy just walking through haphazardly, knocking like, you know, the villains to one side and everything. And it just looks, it's one that I'm going to sort of, you know, when we start showing the TV show proper, I'm going to give a go because it was, there was enough in there that led me to think, you know, this could be, you know, this could be something decent. So the trailer, then again, you know, I absolutely love the Preacher trailer and that sort of like, you know, fell out of them. That did not reach, but the trailer alone, it's, you know, looks interesting. I think if you ever seen the Ted movies, I could be wrong on this, but I think the guy who plays the Tick is the guy in the Ted movies who plays the guy who turns out to be the guy who basically turns out to be gay.
Let me
and the sort of like the real sort of tough guy who basically sort of, you know, who basically turns out to be gay. I think it's that guy because he did the voice in Family Guy of the policeman in the wheelchair.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think it's him. It was hard to tell in the Tick ghetto, but I thought it looked like him. I could be wrong.
That's not the original one you're thinking of? The original iteration of the Tick, not the new one, the Amazon version.
Don't think so.
Oh, okay. I'm just checking.
The one I watched was definitely the Amazon one. So I'm thinking it's I might have to check that, but the trailer, you know, it looks to me like this one could be a sort of, you know, a decent one. And like I say, it's only 20 minutes. You know, so it's worth basically giving this a go.
Okay. I'll be sure to check that out, Dazza. Funny you should bring that up. A TV show based off of a comic book series. But Dazza, have you been reading anything as of late?
To be honest, I've not, by the way, I've totally got that wrong. the Tick star, it's actually a British guy.
I knew it.
Yeah, so I've totally got that wrong. Basically, if you've seen Guardians of the Galaxy, which I'm sure you have, the pilot of the Nova Corps.
The lead pilot of that,
who basically makes the comment, I can't believe I'm, taking orders from a raccoon. he's basically, he's the one who plays he's the one who plays the Tick. He's actually a British actor. I should have known him. But yeah, so that's that.
The good guys.
Yeah. So, so basically what I've been reading, I've not actually been reading comic books, anything different from what I normally read. I do want to say, though, I read another issue of the Batman storyline with Gotham, with the two Gotham.
Oh, you read the issue from last week. What'd you think?
Yeah, really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I have really, really enjoyed this comic.
It was a slow start because I was someone who read the issues week to week, and especially when I read the first issue and the second one back to back, I was like, "Wow, this is the guy who's." I don't know if you're going out of your way to read Dazza, but if you really like this from Tom King, I'd recommend his Vision that he's doing right now from Marvel. That's amazing. That's probably, if I can be objective, mine and Alex's best. That's our favorite comic book right now. As far as objectively, it's like it's so good. And the idea that they got that same writer to write Batman when they originally announced all of the creative teams on DC Rebirth, that was the one we were super pumped for. And I was sort of disappointed when I read the first couple of issues of his Batman. And I was like, well, I sort of justified it. It's like, well, his Vision took a while for it to get going. And judging from the latest issue of Batman, he's a slow starter. He waits things to boil up. And it's in this issue where it really seems to find its voice, it hit its stride. It's a really good story.
Yeah. I mean, this is, out of all the Rebirth ones I've read, this is one that sort of, to me, has been the spirit of what I wanted from this whole reboot, because it's basically a superhero story that's got sort of like some meat to it, but I think that people who are joining for the first time or checking it out could get really into really, really easy. You know, it creates, you know, a couple of new characters who basically, you know, the threat's understandable and everything. And I just sort of have really enjoyed this, you know, this whole thing. And there's so much going on in there. I mean, I really enjoy the whole Alfred stuff where he put on the Batman outfit and everything, and he was sort of, you know, and just, and he was sort of talking to himself about how he'd sort of like made a pledge to Bruce Wayne's father, and sort of, but he made a joke about how, well, it's not as if you're going to go down an alley and get murdered, is it, or anything like that. I just thought,
oh, too soon.
Yeah. I just thought it was like a, you know, it's been like a really entertaining story. I've really enjoyed it. And the artwork I've absolutely loved, because it's sort of, it's like a traditional superhero type artwork, but it just sort of plays so well with the sort of scenes, like the scene where he basically sort of does, where Gotham does the landing and everything. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I've just really, really enjoyed this, you know, this series. And it's sort of, it's basically one of the, I'm going to sort of keep with this Batman title to see where this goes, because I think I've sort of like really, really enjoyed it. Sort of a good back to basics superhero story. And, another thing I sort of read that I really enjoy this week, I really enjoy this week's Star Wars comic.
That, you know, that's a book that I feel guilty because I guess we stopped reviewing that book because I, you know, I read it and it was always, okay, these are out of continuity stories, but they're not, they can't be that important because they don't want to pigeonhole where they want to take the films. So they're sort of stuck having to write these sort of non, I guess these really small, unimportant stories. So I think that's why I ultimately dropped the Star Wars title. But it's never been bad.
I mean, this issue I really like, because the whole thing was set around a battle in space. And that's not something we've had much with in the actual comics themselves. I think we had a little bit in the Vader Down series. But generally speaking, it's basically been sort of like them sort of having like, you know, the sort of the gun battles and stuff. This was like a dogfight issue. And it, what I really loved about it in the, on the first page, you get the crawler that you get every week. And then when you open that page, the first thing you have a double spread of basically this big battle with the X-Wings and a Star Destroyer. And it was just like, it was almost like a movie thing where it just explodes into life. And it was just like a really, really good story. I think it's a strange one with this, Star Wars comic, because you think because basically this is the events between, New Hope and Empire Strikes Back. And the way they've sort of got it at the moment, they've got that the rebellion is growing and sort of getting victories against the Empire. But it's, if they're going to sort of, they can't basically keep this storyline up forever, because obviously there's got the events of Empire Strikes Back. So at some point, they're going to have to basically have the Empire getting the upper hand again. Because if you remember at the start of Empire Strikes Back, they're basically all in hiding. They're basically, because the Empire's driven them in there. So they're going to have to sort of, you know, turn that around at some point, so we can start basically building towards them being on Hoth and everything like that. So, but one of the things actually, what you mentioned about these being stories that we sort of aren't going to have any effect. Apparently, there's rumors, because in the comic, but what a really big deal, it turned out that Han Solo had a wife. They're actually sort of, rumors that they are casting someone to play Han Solo's wife in the Han Solo movie.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, because these comics are, one of the things about these comics and any novels that they write going forward is that all of them are going to be considered canon.
Yeah, that's the one thing they stressed when Disney bought the Star Wars license. They said everything that had come up until now is no, outside the films, the extended universe and whatnot, they're all non-canon now. With the idea of, we're going to produce, I guess, this, where they eventually produce a novel, but then they're also going to produce a comic book line. And those were all, and going forward, those would be the canon extended universe stories.
Yeah, because in the past, the extended universe novels were never actually considered official canon. The only things that was actually considered canon was the cartoon series. George Lucas would often say that. He said, the novels are basically a fun little extension, but they are not canon. So basically they were there, but he could basically choose at any time to basically have events in them that totally disregarded what went on he could create stuff in the movies that basically just disregarded anything in the novels. So whereas Disney have basically pointed out that everything that they do, all the comics and the books are now, they are canon. So they, you know, you could, so basically you could get stuff that happens in the comics that will basically, you know, be referred to in the films going forward. But yeah, one of the rumors is that Apparently they are casting for a black female, which is basically, you know, Imbi, you know, Solo's wife is that. So basically, you know, the speculation is that she's going to be a character in the Han Solo movie.
Oh, cool. Yeah, for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, who haven't read the Star Wars series, they did this storyline to where, I guess, legally Han Solo had a wife. And they kept teasing that maybe, oh, was Han telling the truth? Is this like a legit wife that he had that he's since abandoned? And sort of spoilers, I guess, going forward if you haven't already read the comic book series. But it was one of those things where they were pulling off a heist and it required her and Han to do this thing where it looked like they were getting married. But unbeknownst to Han and her, it was a legitimate wedding. So I guess legally on paper they're married, but really it was one of these things that when Han was really getting close to Leia, that this woman suddenly shows up saying that she's Solo's wife, and I guess legally he was, you know, she was his wife. So it was one of those things where, like, you kind of wonder what was – I always thought – I kind of knew that it wasn't going to be, like, a legitimate thing, because it's like, well, this doesn't seem like a story they want to tell. If it is true, they make Solo look really bad. And really, it just wound up being a ruse. She was just, she even says she was just messing with Han and Leia, cause really, he understood the way that, Han felt about Leia, and he just, I guess the deal, whatever they were doing recently didn't pan out well. So she, I guess her revenge was just to make Solo squirm for a little bit.
But they played it up, you know, cause they actually got a lot of publicity. They've seen like such as some like newspapers and stuff, but I think they played it up really well because obviously Leia was able to get lots and lots of sort of snarky remarks at Solo because she was obviously pissed at him, and she kept making remarks about his wife and stuff like that. So they got some like really really good mileage out of it. I have actually enjoyed the Star Wars comics, the regular Star Wars one and the Vader one. I've really enjoyed generally.
I thought
of the other spin-offs, not so much like the 3PO and the Chewie one and the Leia ones, I just sort of didn't take to, but, you know, generally speaking, some of them have been really good.
Well, the Leia one was just, I guess, like a couple of issues. I think it was that was just a graphic novel. The 3PO book was exclusively a one-off, but I know what you mean. What were other series?
The Lando one was pretty good.
I thought it had its moments, but for the most part, I thought it was kind of a nothing story. Are you reading the Poe series?
I read about the first three and kind of gave up on that one.
Yeah, I'm right there.
It was kind of the thing with the two big giant monsters battling, kind of just sort of put me off. I did like the cute little BB-8 strip that they had in there.
Yeah.
Remember that? That one where he sort of like, he plays Cupid for the...
Oh, yeah, the now I remember what you're talking about.
Where he keeps deliberately damaging the X-Wing so that the mechanic has to go over and fix it so they can get talking to each other. I thought that was a cute little story.
That was sweet, yeah. But yeah,
One of the things I've read, just to plug this out there, because my Suicide Squad, obsession. I bought I don't normally bother with these. The making of books. Normally I find them basically just like a cheap cash-in where it pays you just a load of photos, a little bit of writing and just not much substance to it. But the Suicide Squad making of book turned up in our shop the other day and I bought it. Book's absolutely beautiful. It's got loads and loads of photographs. It's got sort of like all the stuff behind the scenes and everything. But what is really cool is they've done like lots of reproductions of stuff from the actual story. So, for example, all the files that you see Waller going through, they've actually sort of they've recreated. You know, when they've got like the squad, the different members, sheet as it was. You know, the crime sheet. It's recreated all of those. So you created all that, lots of photos and stuff like that. And if it's actually got them as stuff you can actually take out of the book. So there's another one where they've got the letters that the little girl writes to Deadshot. They've basically got that in an envelope so you can take that out and read it and stuff. They've got a thing with the Joker where they've actually got some Joker tattoos that you can use. Obviously, I'm not going to take these out because I want to keep it pristine. But it's as far as the making of book goes, I've really, you know, I've absolutely, you know, love this one. It just looks such a, you know, good quality of it. And like I said, most of them, I see a lot of them, and they're sort of, you know, not really worth, you know, very much. The only making of books before this one that I've ever really, really enjoyed is they did some Star Wars ones a few years back for the original trilogy. They basically released one a year. They had one for The New Hope, one for Empire Strikes Back, and one for Return of Jedi. And those were great because we just had so much information on how the films came about, how the ideas came from the original script to the actual, you know, to finished product. And it was just so, so detailed that, they, you know, those books were absolutely awesome.
Okay. If there's anything else you want to talk about before we wrap this show up, I think that's going to do it for this week's show.
Just the articles. I did an article which went up last week, which was basically my top moments of the Olympics, but not the actual, but basically done more for but let's just say the more wackier best moments of the Olympics. So you're not going to find basically Jesse Owens, you know, winning the gold medal in the Nazi Germany Olympics or anything like that. You're not going to find those moments, but you're going to find some, basically lots of moments of cheating and really weird, you know, moments from the Olympics. So that's basically up on Half-Guarded at the moment. And there's also two articles that aren't up yet, but they'll be coming up soon. One of them I've basically, done the ROM Space Night article that I had on the original Comic Conversations site. I basically took that and I sort of edited that a bit and sort of like did a bit of an update, you know, to tie in with the release of the new comic. So I basically put that over there because a lot of people probably haven't read that before. From, you know, so I thought I would start basically taking, because I've still got the original things of those, so I'll probably sort of start converting those onto the Half-Guarded site as well. Incidentally, I did take a look at ROM Space Night issue 2 in the comic shop, and I just thought, I'm not bothering. it looked as bad as the first one. This one was basically tying in heavily with the Transformers comic. And I just looked at it and I thought, oh, yeah, I'm not playing this game. So I basically just ditched that one. It's just put it down to a, you know, leave the memories alone. and another one that I've got coming up, which I posted and should be up there, I would imagine, sometime this week. Basically the top arse kickings. Basically, so
ooh, nice.
In film, television, and in real life. So I've got some, like, basically just one, not fights, but just basically one-sided absolute arse kickings. So I've got them from films, television, and a couple from actual real life. There's also a pro wrestling one.
Nice.
That you sort of, you know, that I think you will really, really like.
Is that one up yet?
It wasn't up today. Basically, my articles normally go up in a week when there's not like a UFC thing. So that'll be posted. The cool thing about this one is I managed to base every single one that I picked. I managed to find the actual footage of it on YouTube.
Oh, awesome.
So as well as my write up, basically there is the YouTube link so you can watch them as well. But I've, I was quite proud of this one. So I think you'll enjoy it.
I'll be sure to check it out. I can't imagine what you're going to put on there for legitimate fights.
There are two basically things that happened in real life, and then the rest are basically film and television. Okay. So, yeah.
I'll be sure to check that out.
I think you'll like the one which is pro wrestling related.
Yeah, if that goes up before I post this show, I'll be sure to link that in the description.
Yeah, that would be great. Oh, by the way, for next week's show, because this will be the last show we have before CM Punk fights. So if you've not already, I recommend if you can watching the CM Punk. They've been doing these little shows on Fight Network, and I think on YouTube now as well, where basically they're showing CM Punk's sort of journey, you know, his training regime and everything as he prepares for his fight next week. So I thought we could basically have a little bit of a preview of the CM Punk and what we think of this fight that's going to be taking place on, I think it's September the 10th, so it's not next week, and it's the weekend after.
Oh, okay. Yeah, next weekend is Barnett versus Arlovski.
That's in Germany, yeah. That's a Germany one, I think, isn't it?
Let's see. I have to investigate. I just know the card, but let's investigate where it's at. That sounds right, but I'm not 100% sure.
I think it is, because I think it's basically on at a reasonable time in the UK, so.
Let's see. It is on. No, it is. Let's see. No, right here. Yeah, you're right. Hamburg, Germany.
Yeah.
Well, what time? Let's see. It'd be on at you at, I believe, 8 p.m., correct?
Roughly, yeah.
Yeah, because it's going to be over here in Los Angeles at noon, so. That is odd, noon UFC. But there's some stuff that's on this undercard that's pretty good. You got Bader versus Latifi, and you have Gustafsson versus I'm not even going to try to pronounce this guy's name. But yeah, it's a fairly decent card. It's a I think it's a is it a Fight Pass show? Yeah, it's
I don't know. Well, I don't. Well,
yeah, it's Fight Pass.
It's in the UK. It's on BT Sports.
Oh, okay. But so for our Western listeners or American listeners, it is in fact on Fight Pass.
It's on Fight Pass. Right,
it's exclusively on Fight Pass. Yeah. All right. I think that's going to do it for this week's show, Dazza.
Okay, look.
All right. So from all of us at HalfGuard.com, thanks for checking out this week, and as always, see you guys next week. Adios.